for your patience and your enterprise in finding this venue, two levels up from where you normally are. So, well done. Welcome to the last of the talks in the series, Writers Reading, which South African writers talk about their books they love. My name is Janet Small from the Summer School Office, and I'm very happy to introduce the last lecturer in this series. My colleague Ingrid Fisk, who's been introducing the course, said to me I should indicate to you that in fact this room is quite a good choice for today's talk, the discussion of Beyond Black, since in this book, which is about seances, this includes seances, has take place in unusual and uncomfortable venues. So perhaps we're helping to set the scene here. Henrietta Rose Innes, who will be talking to us today, is far from a spirit medium, although her material in all her novels and stories does touch on the unknown and the unknowable. She's written three novels, most recently Ninerva, which was shortlisted for the Sunday Times Fiction Prize, and a collection of short stories, Homing. You'll find many of her works downstairs on sale at the bookstores that are on level 2. You might have seen them in earlier when you were walking around earlier. She's contributed short stories and essays to numerous anthologies in South Africa and abroad, and her work's been translated into Dutch, Arabic, German, and Romanian. A writer in residence at the prestigious Lannan Center at Georgetown University, Washington, D.C., a winner of the Cannes Prize for African Writers, and a writer in residency at Zilt, are among her many honors and residencies. And in fact, she was telling me that in April she'll be heading for Bellagio, and I must say, I'm sure we're all very jealous of that, so we look forward to the next novel inspired by that. I think like at least one other writer that you've heard this week, she received her MA in creative writing from the University of Cape Town, where she now lectures and supervises other MAs there. She also has a BSc with a special interest in biological anthropology. I think it's an interesting combination. And it's often reflected in her fiction, which looks at science and its relation to cultural beliefs and practices. In Ingrid was said to me, I must tell you, that this very characteristic of Henrietta, that she should choose the least famous of Mantel's books, the marvelous writer, and we look forward to her account of Beyond Black. Over to you.
Thanks very much. It's lovely to see so many people here. I'm sorry it's so hot. And I hope we haven't left some people on the ground floor wandering like lost spirits looking for home. So I hear you've had an entertaining week of lectures. I'm afraid I haven't been able to come to any of them, but it feels like such a pleasure and a luxury to be here just simply to talk about something that you love. And that's exactly what I'm going to do. This is just going to be an appreciation of a... Is that right? Can you hear at the back? Yeah. Just really an appreciation of a book that I really thoroughly enjoyed, and that in retrospect I see had quite an impact on my own writing. I'm sure many of you are very familiar with Hilary Mantel's writing. Just a quick show of hands, maybe, how many of you have read Wolf Hall? Okay. And Bringing Up the Bodies, also a wonderful book. And of course those two have just brought her such extraordinary triumph in recent years. As you will know, she's won two Bookers now for two books in a row, which is, I think, unprecedented. And Bringing Up the Bodies has also just won the Costa Award, which is another enormous UK award. So she's really having a late life triumph after a long career, which began in the mid-70s. And I want to talk about Beyond Black because it was my first experience of reading her before I even really knew who she was and before she'd written Wolf Hall. And it was one of those wonderful experiences where you come across a book almost by accident and it's quite revelatory, which is probably my favorite kind of reading. And it's her 10th book. It was the one she wrote immediately before Wolf Hall. And soon after reading it, I realized that she was going to become a global superstar. And I felt like I had that gratified feeling that I'd somehow discovered her. That's my goal. I'm also aware that not everybody loves this book as much as I do. I've been interested to see that it's actually quite a polarizing book as well. Out of interest, I don't know how many of you have read Beyond Black. I'd be interested to know from you what you thought, because I know some people find it a bit long and baggy, whereas I found it quite luxurious and entertaining throughout. And I've also been interested to note that some people are quite resistant to the topic, which is psychic mediums. The main character is a psychic medium who can read minds and who can communicate with the dead. And it's been surprising to me to speak to people, but also to read online people's comments on the book, that people are very resistant to this as a topic, which surprises me because I've sort of become accustomed to readers being more open to being accepting of fantasy in the between the covers of a book. But it seems it's a particular hot topic that kind of either turns people on or turns people off. And I must admit that before I picked up the book, my own feelings, I mean, I would consider myself a fairly hardcore skeptic about such things. And I guess I picked the book up because the topic appealed to me, because I was quite looking forward to an entertaining skewering of the hypocrisy of the whole psychic medium game. You know, people like John Edwards, who I consider quite a con man. And she does do all of that. But she also manages to make you, for the period of time that you're reading the book, utterly believe in these ghouls and ghosts. And there were a number of unexpected features of the book as well. I think it's the first time I'd encountered Hilary Mantel's trademark mixture of riotous comedy and absolute horror, somehow, which she manages to do simultaneously. And of course, there's her gorgeous writing. I think any of you who've enjoyed Wolf Hall know she's an absolute consummate master of crafting the sentence. And I also, something that I would like to be able to emulate in her writing is how she takes this kind of quirky scenario, these two kind of odd couple of peculiar women who are engaged in this rather tawdry profession, traveling around shabby parts of the M25 orbital road around London. And she somehow manages to make that, by the end, carry this enormous emotional kick and significance. In fact, I think the book goes on to say some very profound things about the state of modern life and our relationship to history, which I'm going to talk about further. But first, for those of you who haven't read the book, I will just do a little bit of a recap on what happens in it, without spoiling anything. As I've said, it's an odd couple story, and I always enjoy books that have peculiar heroes and heroines, unlikely people to root for. And the odd couple in this book consists of Alison, who's this hugely overweight psychic medium with a very traumatic and troubled past, who can see ghosts that nobody else can and speaks to the dead. And you're never quite sure in the course of the book whether that's true or whether she's just got some rather elaborate delusion. And then there's Colette, who's described on the back of the book as her flint-hearted sidekick, which I thought was quite a good phrase. And she's Alison's assistant. And together they travel around peri-urban London and do their medium shtick. Should I just go closer to it? Yeah. Do I just need to go a bit closer, maybe?
Yes.
Okay. So I've now got the lectern pressing into my abdomen. Anyway, so again, very appropriate. So we have Alison, the overweight psychic, on stage in these shabby town halls and pubs doing her psychic shtick. And it's all very depressing. The way she depicts southern Britain is terrible. It's almost apocalyptic in parts. There's nothing green or pretty or beautiful. It's all just an urban wasteland. And then Colette is her polar opposite. Colette is extremely unpleasant. She's very thin, very colourless, almost completely characterless, except that she's quite mean and a complete skeptic. And I'd just like to read a few lines just to give you an indication of how Colette speaks and thinks. So she's newly become Alison's assistant, and she says, "My project for the new millennium is to manage you more efficiently. I'm going to set you monthly targets. It's time for blue skies thinking. There's no reason why you shouldn't be at least 10% more productive." So that's to a psychic medium. Whereas Alison is generous. I find her likable, although some readers seem not to. Also completely open to the irrational realm. Very wounded deep down, but an open-hearted character who can't manage her own business affairs. And she sees spirits, and here's one of the intriguing ambiguities of the book. As I've said, you're never quite sure if this is the truth or not. The writer never comes down on one side or the other of the argument. You're never entirely sure whether this is her own personal distorted reality or in fact what is happening. And when I say she sees spirits, I mean she sees spirits constantly thronging the world. She's in fact plagued by them. She can't get rid of them. She can't keep them away, and they're not all very nice. So she sees, in one of the most sort of ghoulishly humorous sections of the book, she sees the spirit of the recently passed Lady Di. He's completely sort of scatterbrained and leaves the psychic medium completely exhausted after their encounter. There's also two of my favorite characters are these two vague little old lady ghosts called Maureen and Kathleen, who are the dearest little Irish grannies, who are just vague. It's kind of how I imagine I would be in the afterlife if I make it. They're constantly wandering around the ether looking for each other, and also quite pathetically looking for their lost cardigans and buttons that have fallen off. And every now and then, at unexpected moments in the book, one of either Kathleen or Maureen will pop up and say, "Excuse me, dear, have you seen my cardigan?" And then, more seriously, there's her own particular spirit guide, who she really can't get rid of. His name is Morris. And Morris is a completely odious little fellow. And he comes with all his friends, who are a bunch of shady spirits, low spirits, as she calls them. And she also refers to them as the fiends. And they're this bunch of completely disreputable chaps from possibly the middle of the last century, although some of them seem to be considerably older. It seems a strong likelihood that William Shakespeare is one of them, in fact. And they're constantly tormenting her. They're really malign, but also they're fond of a good practical joke. And she basically can't take them anywhere, but she also can't get rid of them. And I just wanted to read a little bit about Morris as well. And Morris and his friends are the source of a good deal of the humor in the book. So this is our first glimpse of Morris. Nobody else can see him except Alison, although occasionally they smell him. He has a rather rank odor. So she's in her dressing room with Colette before a show. She almost said, "Look out, Colette, don't tread on Morris." He was on the floor, half sitting and half lying, slumped against the walls. His stumpy legs were spread out and his fingers playing with his fly buttons. When Colette stepped back, she trampled straight over him. As usual, she didn't notice. But Morris did. "Fucking stuck-up cow," he said, as Colette went out. So you get a glimpse of him there. And Mrs. Etchells, who was the old lady who taught Alison the psychic trade, had always told her, "There are some spirits, Alison, who you already know from way back, and you just have to put names to the faces. There are some spirits that are spiteful and will do you a bad turn. There are others that are bloody buggering bastards, excuse my French, who will suck the marrow out of your bones." And then finally on Morris, Alison complains about him constantly as well. "Other mediums," she says, "have spirit guides with a bit more about them. Dignified, impassive medicine men or ancient Persian sages. Why do I have to have a grizzled, grinning apparition in a bookmaker's check jacket and suede shoes with bald toe caps?" So basically, this bunch, they're low life. They're smelly, crude, rough stereotypes of a particular kind of dodgy geezer from, I would say, an earlier time, kind of mid-century or the last century Britain. And They like to hang out in places like tobacco-stained pubs and racetracks and betting houses and any places where men of that type are engaged in obscure criminal activity and shady behaviour and practical jokes. And they make her life a misery. And this is all extremely funny. I mean, she's got a wonderful way with dialogue, and she can really capture the entertaining dialect that these people, these spirits use. But there is an underlying, extremely serious darkness to this depiction as well. Because gradually we learn who these fiends actually are. And they turn out that they are all very dark acquaintances from her childhood that she first met when she was very young, either when they were living people or as spirits hanging around her mother's home, which was a place of extreme abuse and trauma for her as a child. And her mother was a prostitute and someone who attracted these low spirits to her in turn. And there were always these dodgy men hanging around the house. And as we learn progressively through the book, the things they did to Alison as a small child were utterly horrendous. In fact, it's some of the most upsetting suggestions of horrible sexual and physical abuse that I've seen in literature. She doesn't go into it in enormous detail, but you get a glimpse of real evil. And it turns out that Morris and his buddies are not just capering clowns, they actually are representations of real evil in the book. And she can't get rid of them. And these men hung around the house and conducted their, in fact, at times murderous business out of trucks in the backyard and brutalized her and left her deeply scarred. And there's more darkness to her psychic medium business as well. More generally, one of the things that she keeps hidden from her paying audience is that the afterlife is not necessarily a place of love and light and laughter. And of course she does the usual stage show, which I'm sure you'll all recognize. She gives people only good messages from benevolent dead relatives. And she doesn't let on that in fact the afterlife is just as bleak and confusing a place as this life can be. And that the dead are not always nice. They are often lonely or confused or wrong-headed. And she conceals this truth from her audience. And often the whole enterprise leaves her utterly physically and emotionally drained. Which is also, for me, I got a kind of a black gratification out of this, because that's what I've always wondered about John Edwards et al. Is, you know, if you can really hear from your dead relatives, what would they really be saying to you? I'd like to read just a quick little bit as well. I thought it was quite a funny depiction of what happens to you when you actually die, you know, when you go towards the light. And she's giving Colette some advice, because Colette is suddenly anxious about what will happen to her when she dies, if this all turns out to be true. Al would say to her, "Keep your wits about you. Don't start crying. Don't speak to anybody. Don't eat anything. Keep saying your name over and over. Close your eyes and look for the light. If somebody says, follow me, ask to see their ID. When you see the light, move towards it. Keep your bag clamped to your body, or where your body would be. Don't open your bag, and remember the last thing you should do is pull out a map, however lost you feel. If anybody asks you for money, ignore them, push past, just keep moving towards the light. Don't make eye contact, don't let anyone stop you. If somebody points out there's paint on your coat or bird droppings in your hair, just keep motoring. Don't pause, don't look left or right. If a woman approaches you with some snotty-nosed kid, kick her out of the way. It sounds harsh, but it's for your own safety. Keep moving. Move towards the light." So I'm going to remember that passage every time I hear that phrase, "move to the light." So, clearly, the psychic haunting in the book is operating on a number of levels here. I mean, it's part of the literal story, but it's also clearly a very rich metaphor for psychological haunting, for childhood trauma, for the effects of childhood abuse, for scarring, both physical and psychological. And it's also, I think, in the book represents something broader, which is something about how the past lays claim to us, how we can't lose our past, and what happens if we do try to lose our past, what happens if we do try to forget our roots and our history. I think that's a very important thing for Hilary Mantel, particularly, is the idea of people losing their sense of history. And she manages this wonderful trick, is that you can recognize that, you recognize that these fiends are really representing her traumas, but they also feel very real. I mean, reading the book, I was never in any doubt of that. So is Alison mad or are the ghosts real? The book keeps it deliberately vague. And she actually has said in interviews that she didn't want to fall into the trap of trying to convince the readers of one thing or the other, into belief or out of belief. And that to write the book herself, she had to herself deliberately enter into Alison's belief system. And interestingly, in several interviews, she talks about her own relationship as a writer to rationality versus irrationality. It's very clear that she possesses this razor-sharp historian's mind. I mean, if you've read Wolf Hall, you'll know how much rigorous research went into that book. She initially trained as a lawyer. She has this kind of extremely orderly mind. And she speaks about how she has to really battle that to actually write fiction. She has to lay down that desire for order and sense and let the subconscious impulses in. I was amused to read, she talks particularly about Shakespeare and how the one Shakespeare play that she took an enormously long time to read was Othello, because she was always just so frustrated with the business about the misunderstanding about the handkerchief. And she just couldn't bring herself to, because she just wanted to go in there and take that handkerchief and sort things out. And I kind of relate to that. I mean, I think it's quite hard as a writer sometimes to stick with the foolishness and the conflict and the misunderstandings that are a necessary part of story. You know, you can't just go in there and sort everything out. You have to allow the chaos to reign a bit, both within your creative mind and within the story. So I found that interesting. And she also quite frequently makes these quite interesting parallels when talking about this book between the work of the writer and the work of the psychic medium. She's actually said that she's thought that if she never turned into a writer, she might well have become a medium. Because she says quite cleverly that actually the two things are quite similar lines of work. And she asks, you know, who else stands up and talks in public about made-up characters that nobody else can see? And that's what a medium does, and that's also what a novelist does. And she talks about her own characters as almost haunting her. When speaking about Wolf Hall, for example, she refers to Cromwell as being always with her and flickering in and out of her consciousness, which is, in fact, very, very similar to the way she describes how some of these apparitions haunt Alison. I had a couple of quotes relating to that. Yes, yeah, so which other self-employed persons stand up in public to talk about non-existent people? And she also speaks about the audiences who go to these psychic medium shows as being kind of like readers, in that they are prepared to dip themselves into this completely separate system of belief for a couple of hours. And for them, it is a kind of playful release to suddenly allow themselves to believe. And then, as she says, immediately after the show is over, they pull themselves straight out of that and go for a pizza. Having been communing with the dead, suddenly they're able to reintegrate with mundane reality straight afterwards. And again, that's pretty much like picking up a novel and reading. And in fact, in the book, Alison is also, in a way, compared to a kind of an artist. The way she's presented as someone who dabbles in both truth and untruth. When she's up on the stage reading people's minds or speaking to their dead relatives, you are aware that she's pulling some tricks, that she is doing a bit of cold reading and making a few guesses and adapting her presentation to the people that she's talking to, which in a way is part of what an artist does and part of what a writer does as well. Interestingly though, there is also a more direct autobiographical relationship between Alison's life and this whole spirit realm, whether you choose to believe it or not. And In fact, in the book, if you know a little bit about her own early life, you can see there are a number of quite, in fact, quite disturbing autobiographical parallels. She also had a quite a traumatic early childhood, unhappy in a slightly strange environment where her mother, in fact, was simultaneously involved with two men who were both living in the house with them. And it was a disturbing, unusual, and quite deprived childhood. And the sense of the spirit was quite strong in that household as well. She was brought up in a fairly strong old-fashioned Catholic tradition when there was a great emphasis on sin, and everybody in the house believed that their own house was haunted. And she also went through stages in her early life where she was put onto psychiatric medications that later turned out not to be appropriate. And so she had a number of experiences that showed her some kind of alternative reality. She talks about the effects of these antipsychotic medications that she was taking at one point, about how they made her body feel almost possessed by someone who was not herself. And in fact, she remembers very distinctly an experience of seeing what she thought was a ghost, or possibly even the devil, outside her house as a child, which is an extremely vivid piece of writing apart from anything else. It's an extremely creepy description, so I thought I would just read that very quickly to you as well. So she's a little girl about 8 years old, and she's in the long grass behind her house. And she suddenly sees something in the grass. I can't see anything, or not exactly see, except the faintest movement, a ripple, a disturbance of the air. There's nothing to see, nothing to smell, nothing to hear, but its motion, its insolent shift, makes my stomach heave. I can sense at the periphery, the limit of all my senses, the dimensions of the creature. It is as high as a child of 2. Its depth is 1 foot, 15 inches. The air stirs around it invisibly. I am cold and rinsed by nausea. I cannot move. It has no edges, no mass, no dimension, no shape except the formless. It moves. I beg it, stay away, stay away. Within the space of a thought, it is inside me and has set up a sick resonance within my bones and in all the cavities of my body. Grace runs away from me, runs out of my body like liquid from a corpse. So how creepy is that? And I think, it shows a number of things. It shows how she kind of equates this vision of another world with sin, with her own fault as well. She says, grace runs out of me. And the way she describes that childhood experience is that it was an experience of feeling that she'd done something wrong and was about to be punished. And the reason that she'd seen something deeply evil, and because she'd seen it, it would now come after her and punish her. And that experience, however you interpret it, that spasm vision that she had seems to have haunted her for the rest of her life. And she talks about it as the moment where she kind of not exactly stopped believing in God, but stopped believing that God was all-powerful and that perhaps there was some other, you know, deeper evil moving in the world or beyond the world. So it's an extremely powerful experience. And she also talks a lot about, she had these health problems throughout her life and also clearly emotional problems throughout her life. And a lot of the medication she was taking was for pain that they thought was psychosomatic. It actually turned out to be an extremely severe case of endometriosis, which haunted her throughout her life and was also extremely important in the things she chose to write about. But she talks about how she doesn't like the idea of going into therapy now, certainly not medication. And usually I would be quite skeptical about those claims, but it does seem to me that those traumas that she's experienced, she has found a way to very productively feed them into her writing. And it seems to me that particularly in this book, Beyond Black, it is quite clearly about her own hauntings and her own problems with the body and with the mind. There's a lot of description of Alison's bodily problems in the book as well. She's enormously fat, and she talks about it as if her weight is this burden that she must carry because it allows her to absorb the spirits and carry the spirits with her. So it's all mixed up with her own bodily dissatisfaction and her own bodily trauma resulting from the physical abuse she had as a young child. How are we doing for time? Right. So then that's the first kind of layer of the story. The story about Alison Collette and the ghosts and the ghouls. And I realized it particularly strongly reading the book for a second time, which I hardly ever do with books, actually. But this one, I had that lovely experience of reading a book that you've enjoyed once and reading it again and suddenly finding further depths to it and further complications to what you thought the book was originally about. And one of the things that struck me was, as well as this ghostly storyline, there was also a great deal of emphasis on the British landscape, the British urban, peri-urban landscape, which he describes in this ugly apocalyptic way, more than is really called for, you would think. I mean, she's writing about, you know, south of England, which to some eyes is actually quite green and lovely. It's not a terribly impoverished part of the world, but she writes about it as if it's the end of the world, really. There's an awful lot of descriptions of dug-up fields and trenches of mud and ugly modern housing estates being thrown up over destroyed history, which is obviously a great concern of hers. And I realize that she's also writing about the state of the country, the state of the countryside. And she talks quite eloquently about how, indeed, this is something she feels extremely strongly about. And in fact, interestingly, she writes about the moment in the writing of this book that she brought these two thoughts together, the thought about Alison and the ghosts and the broader statements she was trying to make about, really, it sounds quite grand to say it, but the state of Britain. And it's actually a fascinating anecdote. It's not often you get such an insight into a particularly important point in the writing of a book. She describes how she'd started writing the ghoulish story already. She was going to a lot of these psychic medium shows and observing the audiences in particular. And there was a moment, one particular interaction between a medium and an audience member that kind of turned the whole book around for her and made her realize really what it was about, really what the underlying significance of Alison's story was. And she describes it as the way in which the two halves of the story, the ghosts and ghouls and the state of Britain, cohered for her. And the moment was, she was in some shabby back room of some downity old pub listening to a second-rate medium who wasn't getting anywhere with his audience. And you can picture the scene, and he was really struggling and trying to get people to give him some information and making wild guesses, and nobody was really responding. And he focused on this young girl, like 17 years old maybe, and he was saying, oh, you know, I'm getting a name, an old lady, is it your grandmother, her name's Anne, Annie, and the 17-year-old girl was just silently resisting him, not giving him any information at all. And again, I'm going to read her own words because she describes the moment so well. Speak up, darling, the man begs. And then, shrugging, the girl begins to speak. She doesn't know, she says, the name of her grandmother or her grandfather. She seems surprised that he would think she should. What are they to her? I brood about it later and rehearse it in my mind. As the interaction continued, as the medium tried to prompt her, as she stonewalled him, it became clear that no, she was not adopted, not kidnapped, displaced, or an immigrant. She was just a little lass from Slough whose memory didn't stretch back much beyond last year. Why should it? What interest did old dead people hold for her? And then she says about her own family, her own ancestors. She says, I revere the gone before, even if I can't talk to them. But the little lass in Slough showed me what I most fear, a lack of roots that doesn't even define itself as a lack. She lived in a town where few people really come from, a town where people just ended up. She had no interest in what happened before she was born. I think it didn't seem real to her. It was this fright I received on a summer evening outside Slough that drove the book. The thing that frightens me most is confiscation of history. If you don't own the past and can't speak up for it, your past can be stolen and falsified. It can be changed behind you. I'm interested in the way people remember, and just as interested in the way they won't remember. I already had the character of Alison. I knew her present and wondered about her past. What psychics tell you about their early years is usually bland and sunny. When I glimpsed in my imagination Alison's past, I got another fright. That's really nasty, I thought. It has power. I'll write it. Fear is such powerful fuel. So I thought that was a really fascinating glimpse into a creative moment for a writer. I also love her kind of steely relish of the horror of Alison's story. And in the book, this idea, this preoccupation with people losing their history, losing their roots or turning away from their roots is represented, as I've said, in landscape, in this ugly, what she calls the underscape. There's many, many images of the surface of the land being destroyed and revealing the ugly undersides, which can be interpreted as the literal underside of the landscape and also the dark psyche of Britain being exposed. In one section of the book, Colette and Alison go to live together in a completely brand new, still being built housing estate in an attempt to get away from Morris and the Fiends, because they don't like shiny new things, they like old, shady lived-in things. So they go to this shiny new housing estate, and it's a real gimcrack, cheap place, kitsch place, which is, I'm sure it's familiar to many of us as well, where everything is a kind of historical hodgepodge. You can order up, you know, Tudor beams and an Elizabethan carriage clock, and everything's a bit badly made, and everything falls off after a couple of weeks, and the ground starts to rise up, and the damp rises. She describes, this was a place similar to a house that she lived in herself, and she describes it as an invitation to construct your own English history. And she clearly has an abiding hatred of this kind of architectural mishmash apart from anything else. She, in fact, calls it the devil's work. But you can sense in her this very deep resistance to the vulgarization of history, and the idea of a history of a people who are divorced from their history is particularly terrible to her, both their own personal history, not remembering, not knowing the name of your own grandmother, and also not knowing the deeper history of the place that you live in. And I think it's very interesting that the book she wrote straight after this was her first foray into real hardcore historical fiction since her very first book. Clearly, even in this book, she was feeling that tug towards reviving history and exploring history again, which at the time was an unfashionable thing to do. It's one of the interesting things about her career is that she's pretty much been single-handedly responsible for reviving the idea of serious historical fiction with Wolf Hall as something of serious literary merit. So then ultimately, Colette and Alison, their downfall is they decide to buy a garden shed for their brand new house. And of course, a garden shed is exactly the kind of sort of shabby, seedy little place that Morris and the Fiends love to inhabit. So they come romping back. And I won't tell you how the book ends, but to defeat them, ultimately, Alison needs to both remember her own past, which she has been resisting, and also act in a good way, quite simply. Ultimately, the book ends quite sweetly in a fairly straightforward standoff between good and evil in a fairly old-fashioned Catholic way, sin and redemption. And the way she can redeem herself is by performing an act of love and charity, which she does. It's quite low-key. There isn't a euphoric, triumphant ending, but it's one that I found very deeply satisfying in the end. So I would truly encourage everybody to read this book. As I said, it's not everybody's favorite, but I think if you like it, you will probably love it. And I think also the one thing I would like to say, it's probably not, shouldn't be relevant to one's appreciation of literature, but I also just really, really like her, her figure in the literary landscape. And personally, I haven't met her, but I've been to hear her speak. And she's an extraordinarily engaging figure. She's quite a bizarre-looking person. She's sort of, as a result of her endometriosis treatment, she's very large. And I'm not just saying this, this is actually something she speaks about frequently as being a significant part of her writing as well. But she's got this very small sort of pointy face on top of it and enormous eyes. And she speaks in a very high-pitched, strongly accented, powerful voice. And she's extremely erudite, extremely knowledgeable about her subject, very entertaining. And there's something quite gratifying about her recent enormous success as well. It's been commented that she's pretty much of the same generation as people like Martin Amis or Ian McEwan, but has never, in the whole course of her long career, has never attained their fame or their acclaim. And there's more than a strong hint of condescension in the way that people have written about her books in the past. And even to a degree now, despite her success, there's a lot of condescension towards what is considered a woman's writer, also to her now currently considered a writer of historical fiction. And just her unprecedented success now is not only from the prizes, but also in terms of popularity and in terms of critical acclaim, is just incredibly gratifying, I think, especially to someone who's hopefully looking ahead as a long career as a writer. And I also, it's reading the book again, it's also been almost slightly embarrassing to see how much my little attempts at fiction have been influenced in fairly concrete ways. I think certainly in the last book I wrote there was more than one garden shed and possibly a Morris character. So it's been a little humbling to read the book again, but I'm very glad that I got the opportunity to do so. So that's all I really wanted to say about that now. And I was hoping that perhaps there'd be some questions or comments from the audience. Wow, okay, that's a big question. A very interesting question about historical amnesia in literature and society, but in South Africa. I mean, I think that's, for me, it's the landscape is a very powerful metaphor for a historical memory. And to answer your question in quite a personal way, I think, I do like to write about landscape and about things hidden beneath the surface, because I think that's a rich metaphor for the way the past stays with us under the ground and how it can be hidden or revealed. And I think I tried to write about that in the last book that I wrote, using the image of digging down into the ground to find things that had been hidden. I do think that the whole country has been an experiment in some kind of historical amnesia, and I do frequently find it quite surreal to, for example, to drive through the landscape of the Western Cape, and particularly to see how the landscape is marketed as something idyllic, whereas you only have to dig down very shallowly to find the history that is still there of repression. Sorry, it's a very big question, but I think the things that Hilary Mantel talks about as bothering her about English
English history being suppressed and people losing a sense of their roots, I think is even more potent and urgent here, because I think we are engaged in a conscious exercise of covering over a lot of historical memory here. So I think those things are even more extreme and more bothersome than they are for her. Yes. Well, I'm sorry.
She writes sometimes after a speech. She's
written, yeah.
She doesn't mind getting another prize because she thinks she deserves it to help with all those medals.
Yeah.
But what I want to know is, you know, this is about how to biographically, where do you get that info from? Does she have a blog or whatever?
She doesn't have a blog now. I think she's actually quite a reclusive person. I know quite a lot about it because actually I've just been interested, and I've made a point of trying to read things, interviews with her from years back, actually. But it's also, I mean, it's so tempting, as you've noted, to quote her at every turn because she speaks so articulately and expresses things in such a vivid manner that as you noticed, I was turning more and more to her words. To express, and she also has really interesting insights into her own creative process and into the meaning of her own work. But there's a lot online. If you are interested yourself, there's a particularly good overview of her life and work in the New Yorker, which appeared a little while ago. Actually, I have the title here. Here it is. It's a long piece in the New Yorker from last year called "The Dead Are Real," which is well worth looking at. You can find that online. Yeah, but yeah, I mean, I'm a bit of a fan, also, as you will have gathered. And she's the only writer that I've been prepared to stand around the block, waiting in a queue to have my copy of Wolf Hall signed, which I did at the London Book Fair. Which then I immediately left in the hotel room for somebody else to find it by mistake. Yeah. Thank you. Actually made up of several different elements. I think the woman's writing is one of them. In fact, it was the writer, is it Sarah Hall, was the first person to raise this as an explanation. And in fact, interestingly, Hilary Mantel herself was kind of lukewarm about that as a factor. I think her response was to say, well, I write a lot more about men than most women's writers do, so she didn't feel that was really significant. But I also think in her case it's combined with several other factors. I think she comes from pretty working class roots. She had a fairly deprived childhood, and she doesn't seem to be on the London scene. She lives in the countryside. I don't know, I also started thinking about this because of a comment from the critic James Wood, a very, very highly revered critic, who spontaneously made the comment that he observed her at a conference with some of these other famous male writers that he didn't name names, but the conversation was talking about Martin Amis and McEwan. And so I suspect that they were the ones he was referring to. But he was saying how he was struck by how she was left out of their kind of male banter and excluded from their conversation in a way that seemed quite gendered, I think. I mean, I think the other thing is something that people often remark on is that she hasn't really built her brand in a way that people are advised to do. She's, every single one of her books, except for these last two, are utterly different, almost different genres. She's written memoirs, she's written a short modern novel about contemporary people, she's written like wacky satire. Every single one of her books has gone in a completely different direction, and I think that's also part of the problem for her, is that people have struggled to position her exactly. So one does just get the sense that for whatever reasons she's been somewhat out in the cold until quite recently, although she's always had her critical admirers. And I think also in her own personal reactions to winning these great awards recently, there is a strong sense of a kind of a personal triumph over some of that. Yes. She had endometriosis, but extremely severely. It's a disease where tissue from the womb migrates to other parts of the body and causes bleeding and scar tissue. And it can be mild, it can be extremely serious, and she had a particularly bad case of it, caused her enormous pain, and she had to have operations that seems to have shadowed a good part of her life, and also led to hormone treatment, which changed her entire body. And that's been a kind of, she in fact wrote a memoir largely about her own illness. Not that I'm aware of. That memoir is called Giving. Oh, she just wondered if there'd been any other memoirs. That one is called Giving Up the Ghost. I don't think she's done other memoir.
She's written a short piece about her time, called Ink in the Blood.
Oh, really? Okay, thank you. Yeah. Saying there's a short autobiographical piece called Ink in the Blood. Is that possibly drawn from the memoir?
No, I don't think so. Mm. Mm. And she describes this kind of half-conscious state that she's in, and all sorts of figures visit her during this time. Mm. It's quite revealing. Mm. I haven't read your book talk about, but I can imagine something of it.
Yeah. I think also, just now we're talking about her life story, I think also her focus on These intensely researched historical novels is interesting, because she, as I said, she came from a fairly deprived background, and I'm sure she was the first person in her family ever to go to university, and she was a very high achieving person. And I think part of that kind of academic rigor comes through in her writing, and also is clearly personally very important to her. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's strong class issues at play in her work. So we're all looking forward to the next book in the trilogy, which is The Mirror and the Light, I think, which should be due out soon. The other thing about her is, fortunately, she writes fast, so we won't have too long to wait. Before we go, if there are not any more questions, maybe, I mean, I am actually very interested to know what other people who've read this particular book thought about it, whether it had an impact on them or not. I don't know if anyone... Yes?
That was, and also the use of characters. I think Colette reflected very much, as you said, a very barren landscape. Mm. She's a person with barren
personality.
It was incredible, the mix of all those
The balance is extraordinary. I mean, you can be laughing and you can be like shrinking away from the violence at the same time. She has a real facility. And I think you see that in her historical books as well. I mean, the scene where Anne Boleyn is executed is one of those beautiful but like wincingly awful scenes at the same time. Colette is a really unpleasant character. And I think it's quite amusing also, I mean, the book talks a bit even about visions of hell, and the vision of hell is quite amusing as well, because it's sort of Colette's world in a way. It's quite kind of corporate. The fiends go on training courses to get promoted, and by the end of the book, the fiends have all gone away for modifications and gone on training courses, and they come back with all these nightmarish medieval body modifications to torment her even further. Yes.
I thought the comedy was very much on the surface, hiding this much deeper concern, and the spirit world is very murky. They're no good or happy spirits. And one actually feels incredibly sorry for Alison, because she can't rid herself of all these things which seem to be directly related to her childhood.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I was interested at the comments from at the time about people sort of resisting accepting the spirit world in the book. I mean, I think it's quite intriguing, because I wouldn't have expected that now. I think somehow people, at the moment, there's a trend towards incorporating fantasy into more mainstream literature. I think it's more acceptable. And somehow, back then, maybe 6 or 7 years ago, it was perhaps a little unexpected. People were perhaps a little resistant to it. I was wondering if it possibly has something to do with the way it feels quite not unusual now to have those elements in a serious piece of literary fiction. It's maybe we're in a moment at the moment where fantasy is more acceptable as a mainstream genre. Quite possibly, yeah.
Well, I don't think she does treat it as fantasy, though. I think she sees it as very real. I think she really...
She sees it as real. I mean, it is so real to read it. But what intrigued me was that how some readers found that difficult to accept. Yeah. So I think that's it. 12:15. Thank you so much for coming.